Friday, December 5th, 2008, upon further review, episode number 65. We're doing things a little bit differently this week because we have a special guest on the program, someone whose book we previously reviewed. Dr. Wayne Cristado, the author of Power, Love, and Evil, the book that we reviewed last week, wanted to come on to clarify a few points, and so we ended up having a discussion more than our usual review show with him. We think you'll find it engaging, we think you'll find it intriguing, and as usual, we address our usual series of opinions, ideas, and so on, but it is a little bit different than a normal show. We will return to our normal show format next week, but in the meantime, we hope you will enjoy this interview with Dr. Cristado, and that you'll remember that your opinions, feedback, ideas, and suggestions are always important to us here at Upon Further Review. You guys are the best. You're the reason that we keep doing what we're doing. Enjoy the show. Stop messing with me. You're not missing a thing. You keep going and I'm just showing that I'm okay, upon further review, I'm Greg. And we're pleased to welcome everybody to episode 65 of Upon Further Review. And we have a special guest here on the show today, and I want to try to set this up a little bit. First of all, I should say that I want to thank everyone for listening to us and for your suggestions and comments over the last few weeks. Our Facebook group, started by able-bodied fan Chris, continues to grow, so that's great. And we encourage you to go over and sign up for that stuff and then go do all those weird applications that people do on Facebook. But we appreciate that. And we also want to thank AJ and others for giving us suggestions to review. We very much appreciate them, and they have been added appropriately to the queue. But tonight we have a special guest, and this is in relation to our last show, episode 64. We did a show about a book called Power, Love, and Evil, a contribution to a philosophy of the damaged by Dr. Wayne Cristado. And we mentioned that this was a friend of ours and that we had had a chance to go through and look at the book. And I suspect that in the process of trying to simplify the nuances of the book, we may have
oversimplified.
Oversimplified it and unnuanced it is probably what ended up happening. And so we wanted to have the opportunity to invite Dr. Cristado on the show, who we know very well, and have him speak about it, also because he's a very interesting person to listen to and knows quite a bit about a number of things, including philosophy and how to avoid moral philosophy, since Dr. Cristado will tell you he's not interested at all in moralizing. In fact, he tries to avoid that specifically within his work. So we wanted to invite him on the show to talk about that, and also have a chance to talk about sort of the state of philosophy and perhaps morality to a degree in the world in general today, and how perhaps his work plays into that. We may even have some pop culture references in here. I asked him about The Dark Knight and things like that, so that may come up in our interview as well. So we first want to introduce him onto the show. Dr. Cristado is the Associate Professor of European Studies at the University of Hong Kong. He has produced a number of books, several from Ashgate, including The Metaphysics of Science and Freedom from Descartes to Kant to Hegel, and Great Ideas in the Western Literary Canon, and a number of other ones as well. And he's published articles in international journals and chapters and books on Marx, Kant, Hegel, Heidegger, Vogelin, Kassirer, Rosenstock, Huessy, and if I'm wrong about the pronunciation, I'm sure he'll correct me, and Rosenzweig. So he has done a lot of work on a lot of not just philosophy, but European studies and literature and so forth. And we had the good fortune of meeting him a few years ago at a conference and have stayed friends since that time. So we are happy to welcome into the show. Welcome, Wayne.
Hi, Greg. How are you? Let me just say that you did use the word moral too. I saw that come in at the end. You said I might talk about morality
or how to avoid it.
I will follow through on that straight away because when I heard your show, as you rightly said, I felt the lack of nuance went from the beginning. When I basically think you set it up as I've got a theory and it was a kind of moral theory. So that's. And you brought in stuff about postmodernism and relativism and absolutism. And that kind of vocabulary is one I'm trying to get away from completely. I remember you talking about the good, that's right. And that's a word I would never use. In fact, I don't contrast good and evil. I think that's quite a useless thing. Not because I'm Nietzschean, by the way, who I think is very poor on evil, even though he's good on many things, but mm-hmm. He's very poor on evil. And one of the things I'm doing in my book is suggesting that the philosophical tradition generally, though it is quite interesting, there are one or two exceptions, but it's quite interesting in the last 10 years has somewhat turned around. And I did start writing this in about about 13 or 14, 15 years ago.
Wow, okay.
And when I started writing it, I thought, no one's, not many people doing philosophy are talking about evil. But since then, quite a bit's come out, to varying degrees of goodness or not, but the whole term was in, you know, it was something that people didn't want to use.
Wayne, if I can jump in, can I ask you, do you think that that's a result of events like, for example, 9/11, where rightly or wrongly, you know, evil became part of the sort of cultural lexicon? Is that fair to say is one of the reasons?
I think it was actually happening before then.
Okay.
I think the U.S. tend to see that event as a sort of watershed, but I don't think the rest of the world sees it in quite the same terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was something just brewing. And in fact, my subtitle of my book, Contribution to a Philosophy of the Damaged, it's very interesting that the term damaged, it's like this this word, it's almost like a shark in the water, you know. It's this dangerous presence in our vocabulary that starts to come into circulation. It's not that it was never used before, it is, but it starts to come into circulation around the 80s. And you might recall that much of the television, to some extent film, and to a very large extent popular music, especially, I'd use that term very broadly, at the grunge and metal end of the markets.
Right.
The idea of damage, which during the 90s, and especially what was going on in families, was very, very widely used. In fact, there was a Time magazine article, which I refer to, written in the early 90s, that I can't quite remember the formulation, but was something like, does evil exist, or is it just a result of a damaged world? And the journalists that wrote that clearly didn't pick up on the fact that the people that are tending to talk about damage are quite content to use evil in their vocabulary. Of course, when George Bush came out and talked about, this axis of evil,
yeah,
and Ronnie Reagan had used the term evil empire, that was to use a term in a very moralistic sense of good versus evil.
I was going to say, speaking of no nuance.
Well, that's precisely the kind of dichotomy I think is rubbish, because I don't think apathy is evil. I think evil is a field. It's a field, and mm-hmm. people get wrapped up in that. And in this way, you mentioned stuff about Christianity last week, and I let people know straight away I'm not denominational at all. But I do see that different groups over time may have different insights and pathologies, by the way. And I think all collective groups, like living individuals, which are also collectivities of a sort, I use Leibniz in my book. And, if you think of a human body as an organism full of, you know, atoms or microbes or constituted by all, we can go infinitely all the way down. And mm-hmm. I think that's true of collectives. And I think both individuals and collectives are subject to pathologies all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny when you say that, I think about a few things. On the one hand, I think about the 80s, 90s latchkey kids, all of the divorces that were happening and people talking about divorce and how it affects our youth. And I think about what I mentioned last time of the strength-based theory of people trying to study how certain people are able to experience certain things that happen to them and come through it while others completely debilitates them.
That's right.
And then the other thing I think about is that research that one Japanese scientist did on water, where he put different messages on water bottles or he did certain music and stuff like that, and then studied the possible effects on water. And his theory, of course, was that...
I don't know.
His theory was that we are made of water and that these messages, negative messages, these different musical aspects can affect us all the way down to our molecular level.
Mm-hmm.
And so he did things like he took a water bottle and then wrote I hate you around the water bottle. And then I think he froze the water and looked at the crystalline design and how it would differ from pure water to water that had that message to other water that had I love you written on it or something like that.
That's very interesting. I don't go into that kind. I don't really use the if you like, the medical naturalistic model, but I wouldn't want to rule out that there might be something in that. But I don't think I'm doing a theory. I think I said that earlier. I basically think I'm focusing on stuff that most people miss.
Right.
But usually people that have seriously suffered don't miss it. And again, I'll use that example of a lot of metal music, which I once wrote a piece on, that they haven't missed it, they've seen it, and they've been in it. So it's a discourse from the inside rather than the outside.
Well, in fact, the inscription to your book says, the frontispiece says, to Matthew, whose death is part of the shame of the world, and the young woman who said, I'm damaged, and then showed me what she meant. And so there's a sense, I think, that a lot of what you're talking about does relate to one's personal experience and how that personal experience of damage contributes to one's sense in the world of what evil means for them. Again, not trying to use evil in a very moralizing way, but, you know, their understanding of evil stems in part from their knowledge, from their experience of damage.
I say in the book that evil is not a moral term, it's an existential term. So if I were to use, say, you know, that car is, you know, that's got rust on it, on the car, or there's a virus here, you know, that's why people are all sick or something.
Right.
I don't think that's a theory if you know that that's what it is, if you can see it. And in the book, I suppose, I'm trying to show people a certain kind of attentiveness. The woman I'm talking about knew exactly. She actually said, I'm damaged. You know, that was, it was interesting that a psychiatrist just wrote to me a couple of weeks ago, out of the blue. I'd never heard of him. And he had come across this this chapter of the book, and he said he read it, and he actually sent it off to a friend of his because he liked it so much. And the first client he had when he came back from holiday said, I'm damaged. And he said the language that was used was very resonated so strongly with him in that session from what I'd been saying in the book. And that's my point in a way. You know, I started saying that the word damage started to be used. And Clear's point about the latchkey kids and in fact, a very angry generation that didn't experience their parents' freedom, which had been, if like, fought for so hard or strived for with such severity, if you like, put a term that might be negative, in the 60s. And the outcome of this was, you know, something negative, which they'd never imagined. And this is exactly what I think happens all the time. I think, to a large extent, evil is not caused by moral intention at all. It's nonsense. It's caused by, if you like, if the word cause is even the right term, but by inattention. And it's inattention then may lead someone to, we do it to each other, we make each other, and we beat each other, and we make each other into a certain shape. And I just want to pick up on one other point of Clear's, because it's relevant to this.
Yeah.
It's why do some people, you know, want to harm the world and injure the world, and others don't, even though they've been through some horrific experiences. And in a way, these are imponderables. I'd just say that people that are broken, and that's really what I mean by damage, because we're all chipped and cracked in some ways through life. It does it. But if it's done at the wrong time, if it's done before the potencies of what it is that help orientate us in life and also by orientation help us be more open and capable of giving and receiving love, if those capacities are broken, some people may be able to compensate for them in a certain way that doesn't wound and injure those around them to the same extent. Others just may not happen. And I think one would have to be a god to know who that will happen to and what they won't, because life turns around an infinite series of, or infinity of, incalculabilities. But what you can say is if you do certain things to certain people, then they're going to be broken in some way. So whether they, just as you can say that if you poke someone's eyes out with a hot stick, they're going to be blind. But it doesn't mean that in their blindness they won't develop other capacities, but it doesn't mean because they're blind they will.
Right. I mean, obviously, the belief system of the psychologists that developed that theory is that they're of finding what, quote unquote, strengths there are in certain individuals that make them have more, as they would term, positive outcomes after the negative things that happen, the trauma, let's say, the trauma that happens to them, as opposed to certain other people that don't have positive outcomes. What is it within those people? And obviously, you know, with every belief system or lack of belief system, you know, they're scientists, so they're trying to see what it is pragmatically within these individuals and define it within their own terminology. Other people might say that something else is going on, right? That their body is reacting to it in a different way, or their soul is reacting to it in a different way. But they would say that there are certain defining characteristics around certain people that then affect the outcome after the trauma.
Yes, again, I'll come back to, I think it's what powers have been cultivated or are there. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, our natural abilities, it's very hard to know. I mean,
right.
If you look at a one-year-old baby, it'd be pretty difficult to predict what they're going to be like when they're 30, 40, 50, or 60.
Mm-hmm.
So, our whole way of looking at reality generally that's so widespread, it tends to be based on what I think is a total myth, rubbish, of how much we can plan. And there's too much weight given to consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think our instincts or emotional intelligence, all that kind of language also in psychology, that's very useful and real stuff. But there's whole areas there's a whole group of stakeholders that are very interested in not thinking in those in those ways. I mean, I teach at a university, and that's a classic example, I think, of an institutional framework in which that the incalculable is trying to be ruled out at every which way.
Right.
And the result is just, you know, it's either comic or tragic, but it's something. It's an extreme result of...
Well, I always thought of it as a kind of a modern day version of, you know, biblical doctrines, right? They want some outline of how they can make sense of the world in order to give them maybe some semblance of control or clarity in making sense of everything that happens. And if they can maybe grasp some doctrine in their own right or create one, then maybe things won't seem so scary or so out of control.
Yeah, I'd just nuance that and say it's more catechismal than biblical, because the Bible is actually, you know, a book full of paradox and strangeness when people become really acquainted with it. It's not actually a straightforward moralistic.
Well, of course, yes, but in practice, yeah, unfortunately, most people do.
It's taken that way in practice,
They use it that way.
Yes,
they use it
exactly.
And there is a decalogue there, but it's a moving spirit at work there. And in moments of extremity, the decisions made actually violate any moral tenets. You know,
I would agree with that.
I guess, but let me ask then and sort of follow up on that. I mean, one of the things that struck me about what you just said was that if people are, you know, chipped and broken at the wrong time, you know, before they're able in some ways to have, as you say, absorbed whatever resilience they will receive or whatever, that the long-term implications of that for them can obviously be catastrophic. And that's clearly true, depending on lots of things, including things that we can't really understand, as we've just said. But I wonder then, I understand that what you've written is not a theory, but when you talk about this idea of inattention and that's sort of that evil stems from that inattention or you know, that lack of understanding, you know, what is around us in a way. I guess I would ask, do you see, because one of the chapters in your book talks about actually several case studies of damaged people, serial killers and things like that. And I wonder, I mean, do you think it is possible to repair those breaks and chips, you know, through, and I shouldn't say through the use of a theory, but does reading something like this make a greater understanding possible, and through that understanding, a healing possible or not? In other words, is there something about this that can give people a sense of where to go from here, do you think?
That's a very good question, because why am I writing this? And it really, what I'm writing it for is so that if we saw things that are around us with greater clarity, we might be more creative in how we deal with them.
Okay.
I absolutely despise and hate how we try to deal with evil. We lock people up, we kill them. I mean, we were talking earlier about popular culture and films. To me, it's absolutely so revealing that out of Hollywood, films either end up with people killing as many people around them as they can, shooting their way out of it, or marrying someone. These are, you know, these great myths of the modern mind.
Well, you can go to Shakespeare for that as well.
Yeah, classic these tropes, yeah.
Shoot evil and you marry the one you love.
Yeah.
Which, you know, maybe the world would be wiser if we did the opposite.
We should, and I will hurriedly rush from that topic. No, I'm just kidding.
On our toes more. I mean, that's what happened to divorces. A lot of people want to shoot the one they thought they loved.
Right.
Well, no, I mean, it's particularly a huge problem in America. And again, I mean, you know, I am the social worker on the show here, so of course I'm going to keep going to my things. And that's a big theory behind harm reduction. The harm reduction is focused on not making substance abuse and substance abusers an evil and looking at them purely just in that framework, but instead looking at it as someone who needs assistance and major example of a harm reduction is needle exchanges. And everyone, you know, a lot of American leaders look at that and say, well, no, we have, this is a war on drugs because this is an evil. This is a something that we must
fight. Everything must be a war against something in America.
And instead of looking
exactly
at it.
That language is a war against evil. I mean, it's ridiculous. In fact, a war is already, even that language, a war is already the triumph of evil. A prison is already the triumph of evil. The idea that good will triumph, it's like, you know, just war theory and all. This is all nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, a war is a war is a war.
Yeah.
And where there's wars and where people are killing each other, if that's not evil, then the term is meaningless.
Yes.
And there is a case. I mean, someone like Spinoza argued that, you know, let's get rid of it from our vocabulary. Unfortunately, for me, why I don't think that's useful is that very often damaged people use that vocabulary. Very often people that, certain kind of people tend to use that vocabulary, and then it's mimicked. And so you can't just, it doesn't all revolve around the specific word. It's not like, let's everyone use the word evil and the problem will go away. On the contrary, you know, evil loves to mask itself within that vocabulary.
Right.
It loves to mask itself within religion. That's my whole point. And you notice I use evil as if it's a subject. And I, as I say in my book, I think it's quite a much more useful way to look at it than as if a person is evil. I think the idea that a person is, anyone can do evil at any moment. I have no doubt about this. Now, obviously, I think that certain experiences, certain traumas, certain acts can precipitate that. But I simply don't believe. I love it. My favorite phrase in the, I think I say this in my book, but the one phrase in the New Testament that I really love is when Jesus says, call none but the Father good. That's a very interesting. He doesn't even say he is the good. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that's absolutely true. And even if you take this, which I tend to, as symbolic, as a kind of an attempt by a group of people to make sense of their world who are using a range of symbols, most of which now are completely lost on contemporaries. But not on all contemporaries, but even some contemporaries that use these symbols and tend to it who don't tend to use these symbols. It's about an experience, that one is attempting to make sense of an experience. And as I said, the idea that there is a good person and there is a bad person, that's awfully good if you're building prisons or have a stakeholder in getting elected in some war against something, but it's nonsense. It doesn't solve anything. That's why it keeps happening.
Which I guess is one thing that I wanted, one of the things that we wanted to talk a little bit about, the state of philosophy. And one of the things you said to me before we started was that, you know, you kind of try to keep yourself at a certain distance from philosophy per se, although you've certainly read a great deal of it. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was, I think where some of the original, my unnuancing of a nuanced book may have happened was that I know that you have a, although you are very much an admirer of complexity and nuance, you don't have a lot of patience for the kind of postmodern, you know, throw everything into a blender and see what pops out.
There's a kind of hyperbolic stylistic excess about these guys that irritates me a bit, but I don't see myself in the sort of simplistic, they're all crap camp. But having said that, I think there's a lot of people in academia who just are useless and who have used this kind of stuff to make, I think, rather simplistic, grandstanding, politicized pronouncements and politicized understanding of the world, which I just...
Well, the culture wars of the late 80s
theory
and 90s.
Chasing, theory chasing tenure,
chasing
group inclusion.
Yeah.
And I think there's bad motives and bad thinking going on very widely. But I would say it's equally in other clubs too. I don't like analytical philosophy much because I think that's lost. I think there's all these narratives and ways of seeing things that end up being, you know, just hot air.
So
really,
would you say then that the main challenge then for people, you know, people like us who are in an academic environment, let's say, would you say that the main challenge that we face is to restore a kind of, maybe the idea then is to restore a sense of complexity to the world away from the kind of bipolar positions that it's been placed in? Is that a better way to put it?
I think that's, one, I think that's enormously important. Two, I think the other challenge is that I'd say thought in the humanities, crossing over to the social sciences, has become, in my book I talk about a distinction between reflexive and expressivist speech. And basically reflexive speech is what we do when we totally reflect upon something, and you could say theorize it. Working at a very abstract, at a very high level degree of abstraction. And I think when that becomes separate from expressive speech, when that, for example, when you slap a theory onto literature or onto music or onto, you know, or lyrics or something, I think so that you're looking for race, class, gender, all that, you simplify it. You simplify it straight away. You're looking for one major variable or four major variables, five major variables.
Right, right.
The thing about love and evil is these are clusters of all sorts of things. So they don't neatly symmetritize, if that's a word, into this kind of thing. So, but if you come out, you know, what have you experienced? You've come straight from university college. You've learnt a bunch of moral stuff that makes you think you're the spokesman for the oppressed, repressed,
right,
subjected to the world.
Yes.
And then you go off and, you know, you chase this for the rest of your life. You've got a very clear tenure. I mean, what good are you? It's just an industry chasing an industry. And I say that it was my despair at social theory or my dissatisfaction that led me to write this book, because I think basically, I hear people singing about what I'm talking about. I see it in films and certain television shows, some films. In some therapy sessions it's going on. I mentioned, you know, the therapist writing to me. And in fact, it does seem that my work has been of some interest to other therapists as well. They've certainly been very positive about it, whereas philosophers don't quite know what to do with it. But if you read the book, you see there's quite a bit of philosophy in that. So yes, I think basically, the problem is that people aren't really absorbing their experience, and they're not really being attentive. They don't have to be attentive; they're being abstract. Hmm. And it's an abstract attentiveness that carries the weight in most academic circles today. And that can make you feel great because you've got the keys to the kingdom. But it's not like that. It's the stuff of every day and everything you do, and no one is good, and we all miss something all the time.
So you think
we all make the world a worse place?
Well, I guess that's true. And since we become more like ourselves every day, perhaps the world becomes more like us, however good or bad that might be.
Yeah, exactly.
Which makes me wonder then, I mean, so I just a quick tangent then. Do you think, do you despair still? You said that more people now are talking about evil, perhaps not properly, but more than they were when you started thinking about this book. Do you think it's fair to say, we were talking before the show started about films like The Dark Knight, which sort of makes an attempt to look at good and evil categories and shades of gray in a very, as you say, you know, superhero popcorn movie type of way, but in a different way than the sort of incredibly campy, you know, movies of the past would do. And so I wonder if you think then that there is some hope after all. I mean, is there a sort of movement towards more awareness, perhaps because more people have become damaged? That means that more people understand now what you're talking about? Or, you know, are we still kind of swimming against the tide? Or are you swimming against the tide to sort of show people what, as you see it, sort of exists around them?
Well, there's a lot in what you said. I'm not sure that more people have become damaged. I think, you know,
are we more aware of them then, maybe?
If I use a symbol, a theological formulation that is original sin, I think that's very good. That's a very good formulation. Most people don't understand what it means, but I think it just means that we're in the world and we leave residues of toxic residues around us, and we're not aware of it, and it's inevitable that we will do this. I do think that to some extent we're in a very interesting phase, but let's always live with faith and hope in love. Let's always live with that and the right kind of love. But I think that there are certainly enough pathologies in our system that we should not be celebratory around the fact that in certain bits of popular culture, in certain bits of therapy, in certain bits of literature, there's people talk about this stuff with genuine insight. That of course that's good. I mean, Shakespeare talked about this. Dostoevsky. I don't see my philosophy, if I use that term, as being any different from what can be found in The Brothers Karamazov or in Hamlet. They both see the world very similar to how I see it. They might express it much better. You know, they're great poets, whatever. But they're seeing these things, and I think some people see these things too. But there's a lot of countervailing forces, mm-hmm. and one of them is the, as I mentioned, that the university, I think, is a countervailing rather than a prevailing force in this, and that tends to be where our teachers and journalists and judges are trained. So in some way we're inducting them into blindness, I think. Our whole reflexive culture, I think, is severed. In some ways, I think Christian culture, in some ways, now I've got to be careful here because this culture came apart for very good reasons, and I'm very sympathetic to that led Spinoza to attack it so viciously and want to basically set up a whole new way of speaking.
Right.
But in some ways, Christian culture, there was a greater integration of personal, of the expressivist and reflexive culture for a while. But I do think that these different capacities that we have to be thought about very carefully before they can be harmonized. There's nothing natural in the way that they come together. In fact, it's very easily for them to be dislocated. And Hegel talked about the modern self as being a divided self, and I think that's a very true and accurate description. I think we are very divided. I used to notice this when I taught the subject Power, Love, and Evil. If I asked a certain kind of question, I got really what people felt.
Mm-hmm.
But then if I asked another kind of question, I got them speaking all sorts of theoretical nonsense, which had no longer anything to do with what they felt. And if you pushed on one or two questions, they would soon fall in a hole, whether they saw it or not.
It's interesting. Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's funny. I thinking about my own students and what they do or don't see, I think my sense is that my students tend to be, and the postmodern claim, of course, is that we've become more fractured, not just divided, but, you know, literally fractured along many lines, and that in a way it's all of our many selves competing for our attention that causes this problem. You know, it causes, on a very basic level, it causes distractibility, right? And that's partly what you're talking about, that may also relate to that sort of inattentiveness. But I'm struck by how, as you say, when the question is phrased properly, there are still a lot of my students, I find, who can focus. And one of the frustrating things I find is this assumption that they can't focus, and so you might as well not even try to get them to do it. And I find
prefer students to academics, except some friends of mine. And generally, because they're listening to the right kind of music and watching the right kind of television,
yeah,
which is in some ways is much more beneficial educationally. Then I like to sling some things like Milton, Shakespeare, Hegel, Dante, Kant, Kierkegaard, not because I think any one of these has got the answers all right, but there's a certain kind of grandeur and effort in the undertaking, which is very useful as part of one's repertoire.
Yes. So, and that's, I think you took on a bit of that grandeur yourself, if I may say so, Wayne, in the production of this book, which is a very subtle book. So if I were to sort of sum all this up, I guess what we can say about it is that, we've, you know, maybe there are bits and pieces of things that have gotten somewhat better in terms of how people understand this, but that fundamentally we still have a rather inattentive world to the subject of
we live in a world full of lies.
Yeah,
absolutely, world full of lies. From which is apparent in something as simple as advertising to watching a politician speak to watching people who don't even know they're doing it. You know, trying to set targets of knowledge targets, for example. It's just ubiquitous.
Yeah, assessment targets.
So that you know, look. When no one's in prison, when the messianic age comes, when no one's in prison, and then we can settle down and say, yeah, it's all working. But until then, yeah, we're making it all the time. We're doing it. Our forefathers have done it, and our children will do it unless we wake up. And does the world have to be this way? Well, as I previously used the term original sin, and until the age comes where we don't, then we do. I know that's very broad, a broad generalization. That's what I see. So
I just want to point out that I'm not the only one who does them, Wayne, just so you know.
Oh, yeah, take comfort in that.
Well, I think...
Nor even my enemies.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's right. Well, I think if you folks didn't already think that this was a worthy book to get and an interesting person to check out, I think that this conversation has proven even more that fact. So we very much want to thank Dr. Cristotto for coming on with us again, or coming on to this, I shouldn't say again, coming on to this and sort of clearing up some of my, as I say, un-nuances. I'll put this more on me than on Clea's shoulders. And we appreciate very much your having a chance to come on and speak about it. And I hope we'll be able to have a chance to to do that again. I mean, how many people do I know who can speak with such facility about Heidegger and about Johnny Rotten and the, you know, Van Graaff generator? So, I mean, anyone who knows progressive music and philosophy, you know, equally well has got to be worth my time, right? So,
well, thank you, Greg. And I'm going to give a shameless plug to my album. Now it's CD Baby called When the Night Does Fall. So I sing about some of this stuff. There's a cast full of characters, and death is all around, and there's love and evil at work in that album.
Yeah, and I've heard some pre-mixes of those songs, and they're excellent, and I'm actually looking forward to getting that CD shortly after we log off tonight. I'm going to go over and order it. So you definitely should check that out. Give the title again, Wayne.
When the Night Does Fall.
Okay. When the Night Does Fall, and you should also check out Power, Love, and Evil from Merdopi. I gave the website for that last week.
It's a bit expensive. Get it for the library.
You know, There you go. Just get it from the library. Or, you know, or whatever, steal this book, right? It used to be steal this album, so steal this book. But thank you very much, Wayne, for coming on, and thanks to everyone for listening, as always. We will see you guys soon next week upon further review. I'm Greg.
I'm Clea.
See you soon.
Cheers.
The proceeding was a presentation of Upon Further Review, hosted at www.furtherreview.net. As usual, all rights are reserved. If you liked what you heard, please vote for us at podcastalley.com, vitalpodcast.com, and add us to your list of favorites at podcastpickle.com. You can leave us a comment at www.furtherreview.net, drop us a line at upon@furtherreview.net, or give us a phone call or send a fax to 206-339-UFR1. That's 206-339-8371. And lastly, don't be afraid to express your opinions. We know you have them. Let them out. Feel the power. Or you can just blindly accept whatever we tell you is fact. That'll work.
Bravo!
I loved that.
Oh, it was great.
Well, it was pretty good.
Well, it wasn't bad.
Well, there were parts of it that weren't very good, though.
It could have been a lot better.
I didn't really like it.
It was pretty terrible.
It was bad.
It was awful.
It was terrible.
Get him away!
Hey, boo!
Boo!